Good morning and welcome to Mornings for the Master here on the Gospel Radio Network. Certainly always thankful that you can join us. Have Ryan Smithy this morning joined by Chip Horton, and here in a rather wet morning here in Northeast Texas, but certainly thankful that we escaped any greater storms, and thankful that we can continue with you as we go through the Old Testament and find ourselves in 2 Samuel. So if you'd like to be turning there, we'll be in 2 Samuel chapter 12 here in just a moment. But April continues to be a busy month, and I do want to set out a reminder for you as we are looking at some of the events that are going on in this area. First thing, we want to remind you that Richard Rutledge is continuing a gospel meeting at the Westside Church of Christ in Idabel, Oklahoma. He is looking at lessons in lyrics, and want to remind you this meeting goes on through Friday night, and so you have opportunity tonight through Friday night at 7 p.m. To be there at the Westside Church of Christ in Idabel, Oklahoma. Looking tonight, Is Thy Heart Right with God? Angry Words tomorrow night. God Give Us Christian Homes, and then Blessed Be the Tie. And then another very busy weekend. We had a weekend of gospel meetings here recently. Well, if you're in the Northeast Texas area or the East Texas area, you once again have great opportunities before you. The Maybank Lectures coming up April 21st through the 23rd, that's a Friday night through Sunday, are going on this year. They are looking at Convicted, and so want to let you know about that. Again, that's the Maybank Lectures in Maybank, Texas. Also, the Love Lady Lectures going on that weekend, April 21st through 23rd, looking at lessons in lyrics, and that begins with a fellowship on Friday night, lessons on Saturday and Sunday. Always a great study there, and encourage you to get out to Love Lady, Texas if you can. Recently got a notice then for the 23rd. That begins that Sunday, the April 23rd through the 26th. Commonly Asked Bible Questions Answered. And that is at the Caddo Mills Church of Christ, again here in the Northeast Texas area. Final thing that we'll remind you of at this time is a meeting at the East Mountain Church of Christ. And that is going to be hosted by David McCain and his son Ben McCain. It's going to be Thursday, May 18th through Sunday, May 21st. And so, again, if you're in that Tyler, Texas area, certainly encourage you to get out that way to the East Mountain congregation, and certainly encourage you to support these congregations in their good works. Well, as we mentioned this morning, we're going to be in 2 Samuel chapter 12. Richard had taken us up to this point yesterday, and we look here, and you have, of course, the great lament, as it were, of David, the sorrow of his sin, as Nathan will come and convict him. Remember those great words, "You art the man, you're the one." That parable was speaking of. You're the one, if you would apply these things to your life. And, of course, that child is going to die shortly there after that birth, and the servants are puzzled by David and his actions. What is it that he is doing? And ends that last section with those great words, "That child is now dead. Why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I shall go to him, but he shall not return to me." And so David has come to terms with this. He understands that there's nothing that I can do. I can't change that. But that child has died in his innocency, and so he could look forward to spending one day in eternity with him in heaven. And so it's there in 2 Samuel 12 and verse 24 that we pick up our studies today. And ultimately, I think I see kind of two great contrasting lessons that all are going to point back to the sin of David. And for one thing, there was consequence. David's going to begin seeing some of the unfolding of the consequences that God had spoken of that are even going to come about within his own family. And so even though that sin was forgiven, there were consequences that he was going to have to continue dealing with. And then also, at the same time, kind of the flip side of that coin is not just that sin has its consequences, but also we're going to be reminded there is a forgiveness of sins. That even though hardship is going to come upon David, even though there are consequences that have already come upon him, we're going to be reminded there is a beauty, there is a forgiveness of sins. And that's what we get to see first, as there's joy brought back into David's life. And so we would pick up with that idea and see this child that's going to be born. And I simply labeled it the idea that there is hope after sin. Chip, are you there in 2 Samuel 12?
I am.
Let's begin in verse 24 and go ahead and read on down through the end of the chapter.
Beginning with verse 24, David, comforted Bathsheba's wife, and went in unto her and lay with her, and she bare a son, and he called his name Solomon, and Jehovah loved him. And he sent by the hand of Nathan the prophet, and he called his name Jedidiah for Jehovah's sake. Now Joab fought against Ribah of the children of Ammon and took the royal city. And Joab sent messengers to David and said, I have fought against Ribah, yea, I have taken the city of waters. Now therefore gather the rest of the people together and encamp against the city and take it, lest I take the city and it be called after my name. And David gathered all the people together and went to Rabbah and fought against it and took it. And he took the crown of their king from off his head, and the weight thereof was a talent of gold, and in it were precious stones, and it was set on David's head. And he brought forth the spoil of the city exceeding much, and he brought forth the people that were therein, and put them under saws and under harrows of iron and under axes of iron, and made them pass through the brick kiln. And thus did he unto all the cities of the children of Ammon, and David and all the people returned unto Jerusalem.
All right. And in a sense, I guess, as I read through there, I thought of the kind of tragic events, and not just the death of the child, but the tragic events of the adulterous relationship with Bathsheba and David, the tragic events of Uriah and David having him basically having Uriah murdered. Mm. And now there's somewhat this return, that things are, if you will, getting back as they should. The sin has been repented of. We've seen that back in chapter 12. Now David is getting back to his work as he should. Remember, what led up to the sin with him and Bathsheba was he was at home when his armies were off to fight war. And he had dwelt there in that luxury. Well, now he's encouraged, even by his commander Joab, look, we're out here doing the war. We're doing the fighting. We've had victory over the Ammonites. Come and take this credit, if you will, and reign as king. And so there's that victory. But then also those first two verses, verse 24 and 25, we see the joy of the birth of the son. Now, you've lost the first child out of this relationship, but now David and Bathsheba have become husband and wife. Now they are expecting this child. It has been born safely. Of course, this child, Solomon, whose name means peaceable. God would have even sent by the prophet and said, kind of gave him this name Jedidiah, which means to love. But it's this son that, of course, we know is going to go on to become king. He's going to be the heir, as it were, after David. And so there is great joy. As I thought about that, I guess my mind went to Psalm 32. And David, believe the author there and the idea of even this time of his life. And it begins by saying, blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. Blessed is the man whom the Lord imputeth not iniquity, in whose spirit there is no guile. And so there's this idea through this psalm, I was wasting away. I was going through great trouble because of that sin. But now what joy, now what comfort, now what relief, because that sin has been forgiven. You know, I think we learn a great lesson in our lives as we look at David. Here was a man that was not perfect. He's still going to be described as a man after God's own heart, but he certainly had his great flaws. And the Bible doesn't sugarcoat those things. They don't cover them over. But we see one who was drowning in the sorrows of his sin, but then also could find joy when he repented of those sins and turned from them. And here, there could be hope. Here's the birth of this child, the joy that child's going to bring. Here's the hope of those days of that child, that hopefully he will go on to be and to do great things. Here is this victory that has returned to David and to his people. And so, yes, even though sin has been committed, there's still hope and there still can be joy after that sin's dealt with. And my thoughts there, I guess, laid along the lines of the idea that, you know, sometimes people in this life, I think, get this idea, well, if you knew what I did, if you knew the sins that I had committed, you wouldn't talk to me about the hope of the gospel, when in reality, that's the person that needs the hope of the gospel. That's the one who will recognize his sin, the one who even has some mourning or recognition of their sin. And would hopefully respond in humility, I need the forgiveness of God. Here was David, an adulterer, a murderer. Here is David who had not just done these things, but he had schemed them in his mind, and yet he could find forgiveness. And we can find forgiveness, and yes, even though that sin may have been great, even though it may have great consequences, nevertheless, there can be joy and there can be hope in our lives. And so I thought a beautiful beginning to what otherwise is a rather bleak series of events that happens as we study this morning. Some thoughts for us there this morning, Chip?
Well, the comment that you made, that people always say, you know, you just don't know what I've done and where I've been. You certainly would want to point to someone like David, but you might also point to someone like Saul of Tarsus. You know, as he wrote to Timothy, even in that first chapter, he says, I thank Christ Jesus our Lord, you know, because of what he did for me. He said, I was a persecutor, I was a blasphemer, I was injurious. He said, but I obtained mercy, and that was made possible because of the blood of Jesus Christ. So I've always said, you know, if Saul of Tarsus or one like David could certainly be forgiven by God with all the things that they had in their past and under them, then certainly a man like me or you could be as well. So
that's right. You know, and sometimes, you know, we look at people and we maybe prejudice gets the best of us. We've prejudged. I mean, look at the sin of that individual. They wouldn't be receptive to the gospel. Look at the lives they're living. They may be the most receptive. Because unfortunately, sometimes those who have, quote unquote, grown up within the church or have, you know, been reared in godly families, you might easily get the idea of someone that has the idea, well, I've been a pretty good person. You know, yeah, I've done a few little things, but I haven't really done all that much. And we can have a little too much self-confidence. You take a person that has reached the point that David did in his life, that Saul did in his life, that others would reach, and there's a rock bottom there that says, I'm guilty. I know my sin. I know the great things that I have done. And if you can get that person to listen to the gospel, I think you have a person that's primed to have the response of Acts chapter 2. Men and brethren, what shall we do? I want to know the answer. And the joy of the gospel is the answer is right there in Jesus Christ.
Right.
And so wonderful, wonderful hope before us. But I really label from here, and we're going to try to get through some events of chapter 18 and verse 33, largely just summary, kind of review what's happening here, encourage you to go back and read this section verse for verse. But I've largely labeled this as two groups: the hope after sin here in chapter 12, verse 24 through verse 31, but then from chapter 13 through chapter 18, it's really the lingering consequences of sin.
Yep.
Now, Nathan had informed David not just of the forgiveness of his sins, that yes, God had forgiven him, but he also spoke, there are going to be consequences that you are going to continue to face. And if we could back up into chapter 12 for just a moment and look at those consequences in verse 10 through 13, I think you're going to see that's exactly what begins unfolding here in David's life. So 2 Samuel 12, verse 10 through 13.
Now, therefore, the sword shall never depart from thine house, because thou hast despised me and hast taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be thy wife. Thus saith the Lord, behold, I will raise up evil against thee out of thine own house, and I will take thy wives before thine eyes and give them unto thy neighbor, and he shall lie with thy wives in the sight of the sun. For thou didst secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel and before the sun. And David said unto Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. And Nathan said unto David, the Lord also hath put away thy sin. Thou shalt not die.
Okay. And so there was this warning. There are going to be events that are going to happen in your life that are going to tie back to this. And God was certainly going to allow some of these things to happen. And again, they're part of that punishment. If you will, part of the consequences. You've made these choices. Mm-hmm. You've set this stage. And I really think more so than having the image of God punishing David, the more I think about these events that unfold, I look back and realize, David, you placed yourself in a position that these events would occur.
Mm-hmm.
He was not ready. He was not able to deal with the events that are going to happen in his family because he set the stage for them. And we see that right off here in chapter 13. Okay, you've had that hope, but now in chapter 13 you have this event with Ammon and Tamar. And here Ammon is one of David's sons. He is brother to Absalom. That's going to begin playing an important picture. Absalom had a sister, Tamar. And Ammon, who's looking here at this half-sister, is falling in love with her. And really, I think as you begin reading through this chapter, we need to understand maybe he fell in lust with
her.
Yeah,
that's a point there.
There really wasn't a love. That's a, you know, if we could pin a lesson down for some teenagers and even some older people there, be careful. What Ammon was feeling towards his sister Tamar was a desire, was a lust, but it was not a love. We're going to remember the definition of love time and time again through the Bible is seeking that which is best for another individual and not our own selfish desires.
Mm-hmm.
And Ammon has a lust. He's interested in himself. He's interested in his desires and not in what is best for Tamar.
That's right.
And so Ammon is to the point of being sick, in fact, here in verse 2. He fell sick for his sister Tamar. He wanted her in that fashion. And unfortunately, Ammon falls prey to another great lesson. And that is the lesson of watch your counselors. Watch who it is that you take wisdom from. Verse 3 begins to introduce us to this friend, Jonadab. And Jonadab is going to be the one who is going to come in verse 5 and help Ammon hatch this plan.
Hmm.
He says, I tell you what to do. You want your sister Tamar, just act like you're sick. Go in upon your bed and say, oh, I'm so sick, and send to the king and say, oh, I need my sister Tamar. If she would come and she would cook, then I just know that I'd get to feeling better. And Ammon listens to that foolish counselor. Again, we need friends that are going to steer us in good directions. 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 33 comes to mind. The idea there that evil companionships corrupt good manners, or you know, those corrupt friendships can corrupt good manners.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Ammon has here in Jonadab. And so he has listened to this foolish counsel. Again, we need those friends that are going to lead us closer to God. We need those friends that are going to build us up and encourage us in that which is right, not those who are going to encourage us in the ways of evil. And so if there's a lesson you can learn there, that's certainly one of them, I would hope.
It's one Job learned.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, him and his friends.
That's wow. Right. I've always thought there of Job's friends, and the best things they ever did was sat there for 7 days with their mouth shut.
That's it, right?
Things only went downhill when they opened their mouths. We need those who will encourage and be careful who we surround ourselves with. And so with the plan hatched, those events unfold. Ammon will call for his sister Tamar, send everyone else out of the room. He will lay with her, but then as we drop down into verse 15, 2 Samuel 13 and verse 15, we see the end of that.
Ammon hated her exceedingly, so that the hatred wherewith he hated her was greater than the love wherewith he had loved her. And Ammon said unto her, arise, be gone.
Okay, now his lust there has turned to anger. Another thought that came to mind as I was reading through that is the idea, how long will it take us to learn sin will not fulfill?
Mm-hmm.
He thought, this is that great desire. This is that which is going to make me happy. This is that which I want. And yet when he had it, it didn't make him feel better.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't fulfill the desires of his soul. In fact, now I would say there's a man that stands before you that feels empty.
Mm-hmm.
What did he need? He needed to turn unto God and do that which was right. Instead, he had sought after the lust of his flesh.
Mm.
And so this love that he thought he had now turned to anger. He's going to just send this sister of his away.
Mm-hmm.
Now we begin to see, though, I think, the shortcomings of David. In verse 21, we're going to find that David hears about this, and he was very wroth. He's angry. He doesn't like the report that he's heard. But there's a point at which I think we can also say David, in a sense, is impotent in his dealing. Well, what does he do? He can look back at his own life, and he recognizes his own sexual sins and shortcomings in his life. I'm not saying that he necessarily feels I don't think there's a soft spot in his heart for Ammon, but I do think there is set a stage here for how do I deal with this? Because I know that I am guilty, maybe not of this particular thing, but of very similar things. And so maybe there's a point here at which he just doesn't know how to handle this. He doesn't know what to do. And it seems to a large part, he gets angry, but he doesn't do anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
There's no repercussion here that comes upon Ammon. There's no answer that he has to give to it. And again, that's where I see that stage. Daniel, you've made a bed. And now because of your sin, you're going to find it hard to adequately deal with the sins of others.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the point of 1 Corinthians chapter 5 in that idea, a little leaven is the whole lump.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't deal with one sin of the congregation, how are you going to deal with the next sin?
Mm-hmm.
If you overlook, if you turn a blind eye to one thing, then when another issue comes up, well, they're going to point back and say, but you didn't say anything to them.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't deal with that consequence or that sin that was over there, and so now you find yourself in a tough spot. What do we do? How do we deal with it? And I think that's where David found himself in not being able. His influence had been harmed, certainly in his family. They're going to have a hard time looking at him and saying, well, David, why don't you practice what you're now trying to preach? And so he had created, he had set up this stage to inadequately deal with the situation.
Yep.
Before we move on, anything necessarily that's come to mind?
Well, just right then, it seems like sometimes it's I can imagine that he, being a man of war, it was easier for him to say go here and go there and go to battle. But when it came to something like defending the law of God, here is, a bash at the law. I've got in my notes here Leviticus chapter 18, which speaks against this very law or this very act. Mm-hmm. And so when we fail, obviously he goes back and he, defiled the law as well years before. But here we have this opportunity to be a defender of the law. And he, as you said, stays quiet, keeps his mouth shut. And sadly, a lot of that goes on in the world today. Mm-hmm. It may very well be that the reason that so much of this promiscuous activity in the world today has risen to the level it's at is because too many of us in the world have just kept our mouths shut.
Mm-hmm.
You think about the bathroom deal and, the rainbow flags flying everywhere and, and the squeaky wheel gets the oil. Maybe we hadn't squeaked enough, but here's an event, and it's just going to get worse. I mean, when sin abounds, you've got to be like Nathan. Mm-hmm. You've got to be able to call it for what it is. And certainly it's easy for us to look back and say, oh, David should have. But, it's a weakness that all men ultimately have in at some level,
Right. And so largely the image I get there is one that David has not dealt with this. Mm-hmm. And so Absalom will care for his sister, Tamar, but Absalom, his wheels begin to turn. In fact, it tells us in verse 23 now, 2 years have passed, but he has not forgotten this event. He hatches his own plan, whereby he implores his father David, "Can I have all of the children out? I want to have a feast." And it's here at this feast that Absalom is going to kill his brother Amnon. He's going to try to do that which is right in his eyes to bring about justice, as it were, for his sister. And so now Absalom has tried to deal with this problem on his own, and a consequence of that is going to be a strained relationship, a separation, because Absalom, verse 38, is going to flee. He's going to be there 3 years. Notice verse 39, "And the soul of King David longed to go forth unto Absalom, for he was comforted concerning Amnon, seeing he was dead."
Wow.
What do you do?
Yeah.
Now Amnon has risen up in anger against his brother, David, and he has fled. David, in some sense, I think, is looking here and say, I know Amnon was guilty. Maybe that situation's been taken care of, but still I've lost a son. Now Absalom is separated from me. And we see, I think, the sad picture of when sin gets out of control.
Mm-hmm.
And this has kind of snowballed here into this effect where now you have these strained relationships. You've led to the separation. You've led to the death of a family member. You've led to the defilement of another family member concerning Tamar. And so all of these things have snowballed together. And that's the sad picture that we're left with at the close of chapter 13.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're left with a king that's pining, as it were, for his son. There is a missing here, but he doesn't know what to do. How do I respond to Absalom? How do I deal with this? What do I do? I long to see him, but I don't know how to deal with the choices and the actions that he's made. And finally, here in chapter 14, we're going to have those relationships are still going to be strained, but the separation as such is going to end. Joab is going to get involved. And through a woman that goes and presents a situation to the king, is going to say, "This is what you've done with Absalom. You've pushed him away, and it's time for you to call him back." And so, again, those are some of those sections that I would encourage you to read through. I'm going to drop down to verse 21, where the king finally agrees. He said, "Yes, I have done this thing. Go and bring Absalom again, but even as he is brought again, he will not see my face." And so he can return. I'm not going to seek after him. There's no danger presented for him. He can return, but I'm not going to go, and I'm not going to see him. And so still, you're strained, but you haven't really been united together. And so this continues to be this issue between them. But there's some foreshadowings here, I think. Look here in chapter 14 and verse 25, and we'll begin to see some things are going to begin to happen.
But in all Israel, there was none to be so much praised as Absalom for his beauty. From the sole of his foot, even to the crown of his head, there was no blemish in him.
Okay, and so we begin, even just to a tiny degree, we begin to see there's a popularity, if you will, of Absalom. There's a draw there. He has a physical beauty. There is a physical attraction that he is admired. And so now he's brought back into Israel, but there's still this strained relationship. I'm the son of the king, but the king will not see me. And so this is once again going to lead to some tensions. Absalom, he says, well, I'm back, but I might as well not be, because I can't go in to see my father. So he is going to scheme in such a way to convince Joab to unite him and his son once again. And finally, that's going to happen in verse 33 at the close of chapter 14.
Verse 33. So Joab came to the king and told him, and when he had called for Absalom, he came to the king and bowed himself on his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom.
All right, and so there is a reunion. There is a bringing back together, but the hearts of these two individuals will not be tied back together. Again, you have the strained relationship of this history. David is struggling, I think, in a sense, with how to handle these events. Absalom, I believe, is feeling some resentment, probably, towards his father. You haven't avenged my sister Tamar. In his mind, he had to do it himself. He still feels this strained relationship that David won't hardly look at me. I have to beg to come into his presence. And again, all of these events are snowballing and leading up to events that will begin unfolding in chapter 15. And Absalom, again, is going to start scheming because of how, I believe, again, because of how he's been treated, a mindset that has been developed within this family. And let's see the consequence of that in verse 1 through 4 of chapter 15.
Let's see. And it came to pass after this that Absalom prepared him chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. And Absalom rose up early and stood beside the way of the gate. And it was so that when any man that had a controversy came to the king for judgment, then Absalom called unto him and said, of what city art thou? And he said, thy servant is of one of the tribes of Israel. And Absalom said unto him, see, thy matters are good and right, but there is no man deputed of the king to hear thee. Absalom said, moreover, oh, that I were made judge in the land, that every man which had any suit or cause might come unto me, and I would do him justice.
There is a plot here that I have no doubt Absalom knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
He is beginning to present in the minds of individuals, you have a need, and it's important. Somebody ought to listen to that need. But, you know, the king really doesn't have anybody to listen to you. If I were king, I would listen. I would handle it. I would make sure that your cause was heard. Now, I don't want to read too much into this, but I think there's a psychology there that Absalom is using to turn the hearts of the people to himself. He's trying to express to them, the king really doesn't care what's happening to you. He doesn't care about your issues. And what's noted to me is Absalom doesn't ask what their issue is first. He tries to put an importance in them. So that's going to develop this rapport. That's going to develop this connection with Absalom. Oh, Absalom really cares about me. He thinks I'm right. Mm-hmm. Well, he hasn't even heard your case. But you're going to have this kind of this care. And at the same time, he's expressing the king doesn't really care for us. He doesn't really have a concern over what's going to happen. And so, again, the result of all of that is going to turn out in verse 6.
And on this manner did Absalom to all Israel that came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel.
Okay, and now here is David, who in many ways has been a beloved king. Nevertheless, the hearts of the people are going to begin turning away from David, turning to his son Absalom. Mm. And so he is, in that sense, a usurper as he steals the hearts away and begins this rebellion. And so what he's now done, I'll make a small remark here on verse 7. There is a mention there of came to pass after 40 years. You know, much more research can be done there. As I understand, many will attribute that likely there was some clerical error. Most of the manuscripts that we have of reliability have that listed as the 40 years. Some have thought they could read into that 40 days. Others believe that there is evidence there that that should have been 4 years. I think that certainly seems like a more fitting time frame than the 40 that would have been an impossibility here over this course of time. So unless the writer is pointing back to some previous event, and it's been 40 years from some previous event, it's likely these things have been happening over about a period of about 4 years, that he's been presenting himself as this caring individual. He's presenting himself as this one who has a love and an affection for the people, and he has presented his father as one who just doesn't care. And so now he announces his plan. I want people to gather unto me, and I want you to proclaim Absalom as king. Mm. And so that begins to happen there in verse 10, that they are to announce that Absalom reigns in Hebron. What's interesting to me is David's response. As soon as this is told, he knows there's this uprising. He knows his life is in danger, even by the hand of his own son. The first thing that happens is he is going to flee. And so let's drop down into verse 14 and see his response.
David said unto all his servants that were with him at Jerusalem, arise, and let us flee, for we shall not escape from Absalom. Make speed to depart, lest he overtake us suddenly and bring evil upon us and smite the city with the edge of the sword.
All right. And so the report, verse 13, that had come to David is the hearts of the men are after Absalom. And so I think he understands here, we've got to get away for a while. There's this uprising. The kingdom has turned. We can't stand against him until we gather our forces together and know what we're fighting. And so here is David. Here is his city. Here's the place that he has helped build up. And he has to flee. He has to run as one who is chased. And I can't help but think maybe his mind goes back to the days when he was on the run from Saul. His life was at danger. And now, once again, he finds himself as the Lord's anointed, as king of Israel, and yet he's on the run. He is fleeing the city for his life. And yet, I love his attitude. And there are various individuals that are going to come unto him. Some he receives, some he sends back as ones who can give evil plans, if you will, unto Absalom to weaken his cause. Some, even such as these priests that we're going to speak about, he's going to send back into the city and say, you have a place. You know where you need to be. You know where you need to serve. And verse 25 is that verse that I had in mind there.
And the king said unto Zadok, carry back the ark of God into the city. If I shall find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me again and show me both it and his habitation.
Okay. And so what I find in David is a man who says, look, if this is the Lord's will, this is the Lord's will. And I will go and may not ever be brought back again. But if the Lord wills, I'm going away and I will return. But I see in David, again, one who is willing to place his trust and his hope in God.
Mm-hmm.
He has once again humbled himself. You know, he reared himself up there in the whole idea of Bathsheba and Uriah and that sin, but now he's been humbled again. I think we also see this man that recognizes this is what God spoke of.
Mm-hmm.
These are the consequences that I'm seeing unfold. My sin brought this upon this people. My sin brought this upon my head, and these are the just consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And so rather than calling out, woe is me, and look at all the problems that I have, and God, why did you do this to me? I see David that says, no, this was of my doing. This was of my hand. And so is then fleeing from the city. I'm going to refer back just for a moment, and there's some question maybe as to exactly when this psalm was written, but Psalm 63. Some, I think, place this at the time of David fleeing from Saul. I think there's a much more powerful attachment maybe to this point of David's life. Possibly the idea certainly could be true of both points of his life. But Psalm 63, he writes, O God, thou art my God. Early will I seek thee. My soul thirsteth for thee. My flesh longeth for thee in a dry and a thirsty land where no water is. To see thy power and thy glory, as so as I have seen thee in the sanctuary. Because thy loving kindness is better than life, my lips shall praise thee. Thus will I bless thee while I live. I will lift up my hands in thy name. My soul shall be satisfied as with marrow and fatness, and my mouth shall praise thee with joyful lips. When I remember thee upon my bed and meditate on thee in the night watches, because thou hast been my help, therefore in the shadow of thy wings will I rejoice. My soul followeth hard after thee. Thy right hand upholdeth me, but those that seek my soul to destroy it shall go into the lower parts of the earth. They shall fall by the sword. They shall be a portion for foxes. The king shall rejoice in God. Everyone that sweareth by him shall glory, but the mouth of them that speak lies shall be stopped.
Hmm.
And I see within the psalm the one who has had to flee. He has known the times of dwelling in the sanctuary of God. He has known the beauty of going into that place to worship God. And now it is as if there is a famine and a drought because I no longer have that presence, if you will. I no longer have that ability to go into that tabernacle or that sanctuary. And so he feels that removal from it, and yet he still trusts in God. And that's the beauty of what I see in David as he is even having to flee. We're going to see that humility again, even in chapter 16 as he's fleeing, and there's this one that is casting stones, and some of those with David said, you want me to go up and to kill this man? And yet he says, no, I'm going to humbly take it. Let's look again there in chapter 16 and verse 10 through 12.
10 through 12. And the king said, what have I to do with you, ye sons of Zeruiah? So let him curse, because the Lord has said unto him, curse David. Who shall then say, wherefore hast thou done so? And David said to Abishai and to all his servants, behold, my son, which come forth out of my bowels, seeketh my life. How much more now may this Benjamite do it? Let him alone, and let him curse, for the Lord hath bidden him. It may be that the Lord will look on mine affliction
and the Lord will requite me good for this cursing this day.
All right. And so I still see within that, David says, no, these are the things that have been brought upon me. I will humbly submit to them. If the Lord chooses to bless me, the Lord chooses to bless me, and he will deal with it. Mm-hmm. And so, again, humility is the key that I see through there. And then also I would highlight verse 23 of chapter 16, that, well, sometimes verses move on you.
Uh-oh.
But there we go. I'm actually wanting verse 22 that we're going to see Absalom going up even upon the roof of the king's house and laying with one of his father's concubines. And again, reflect back to what David was told was going to happen in Second Samuel 12. That's exactly what he was told would happen. His neighbor, as it were, would come in even unto his own wife. And we see his son doing that there at the end of chapter 16. Mm-hmm. And so you have this time of fleeing. You have this time of planning. A lot of chapter 17 is dealing with the counsel that Absalom is going to receive and what to do, the friends and the help that David would receive. I want to get into chapter 18, and you have this preparation for war. Mm-hmm. Basically, what you've had is a mutiny. Right. And I don't believe for a minute David really wants to go forth to war with his son. But I'm the king's anointed, and that is my throne that you have usurped. And so this war is going to come about. But again, how can I say that about David? Well, let's look in chapter 18 and verse 5.
And the king commanded Joab and Abishai and Ittai, saying, deal gently for my sake with the young man, even with Absalom. And all the people heard when the king gave all the captains charge concerning Absalom.
Okay, this is kind of a weird request in a sense. Yes, it's David's son, but he's also the usurper of the throne. We're going forth to war, but would you deal kindly with the leader of the enemy?
Yeah,
right. I mean, that's not something men of war are going to necessarily lightly take. And we're going to see that in Joab. And so war is started. There's this conflict, this battle. And in the course of the battle, again, this is one of those stories that the account that catches our eyes. Verse 9, Absalom in his great beauty that we're reminded of earlier. I guess he has his hair all done up, that great hair that we had read about, and he's going to be riding, and he's going to get caught. Whether his head got caught in the why of a tree or his hair got tangled up in the tree, but in verse 9, he's going to get caught in the oak tree, and the animal, the mule that was under him, keeps on going. And so here's Absalom in the midst of this battle, and he's hanging now from this tree. It's reported unto Joab, and Joab is going to go and kill him, even though he knows the king's request. And so verse 15, he cast him through with these darts, and so that the young man is dead. Now, verse 30, we can drop down even to there. The reports, the runners are going to be sent. They come unto David. The first is a vague report. If you back up to verse 28 and 29, the idea there, especially at the end of that chapter, blessed be the Lord thy God that delivered up the men that lifted up their hand against the Lord my king. There's a voice of victory. But he won't tell about Absalom. He said, well, things have gone well, but I don't really know what was happening when I left. he doesn't want to answer. Mm-hmm. Finally, this other runner comes in verse 31 and 32, and it is told, yes, Absalom is dead. And I want to go to the end of that chapter after having received that message and look at verse 33.
And the king was much moved,
and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, thus he said, Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would God I had died for thee. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son.
Okay, and I simply titled that ending verse, The Lament of David. Mm-hmm. You know, so much of that, these chapters have led us up to this point. You've had the sin of Amnon and there with his sister Tamar. You've had the response of Absalom. You've had this, David kind of being impotent in dealing with these things and not really... You know, he's hurt his influence within his family even to deal with these things. And so this has led up to the point where Absalom would raise himself up even against his father, and now he's dead. It should be, in one sense, a time of great victory for David, and yet it's a lament. We're going to see that, Lord willing, tomorrow, even as Chip continues. But, you know, people are going to be asking, this should be a victory. You've been restored to the throne. Men went forth and fought for you. But where's David's heart? It's on his son. I'm going to suggest for you at least two overwhelming reasons. Number one, I think David understands even more fully possibly his actions and how they have played into the death of his son. My sin set the stage for all of this to happen. And now I've lost the young child that was first born out of that relationship. I've lost my son Amnon. He's defiled his sister Tamar. I've lost my son Absalom. You know, my sin. And even though it's forgiven, here's the great weight of the consequences that have gone forth because of my sin. And I know we deal with this at camps and other things, but oh, if we could impress upon young minds the necessity to seek after God and to be faithful unto him. Mm. Is it any surprise Solomon's going to speak about seeking after God in the days of your youth? Because the consequences of sin can follow us for a lifetime. And I think David's seeing some of those consequences unfold. But I would also have you highlight the difference of how David has dealt with the young infant son that died. That was because of his sin too.
Mm-hmm.
But when that young infant son dies, reflect back to chapter 12 and verse 22. Chapter 12 and verse 22, and those famous words there. While the child was alive, I fasted and I wept. For I can say, who can tell whether God would be gracious to me that the child may live? But now he is dead. Wherefore should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I shall go to him. But he shall not return to me. His servants expected him to have this great lament. And he rises, he washes, and he goes and he worships God and asks for food. And they're puzzled. And he says, well, I can't change it. It's happened. I'll go to him, but I can't bring him back. Now when Absalom dies, he dies in rebellion to the king. He dies in rebellion to God. And there's a far different response of David. And I wonder if a large part of that, not only is David dealing with the consequences of his sin, but David looking and seeing the soul of his son. Here was a son that died lost. Here was a son that died in rebellion. Here was a son that had risen himself not just against his father, but as the anointed of the king, he had risen himself against God. And so there's this great lament. Oh, my son Absalom, there's a love, there's a care there, but I think also there is a great lament over all that has happened. And I would suggest to you there's a great difference even in the death of two different individuals, one that dies in innocency, one that dies in rebellion. And even today, there's a great different lament. When one dies in rebellion to God, or one dies as a faithful child of God, we lament because we've forever been separated from the one that's died in rebellion to God. We're saddened but comforted in the death of one who is a child of God, knowing that there is going to be a reunion in heaven. Not in the same physical relationship that we enjoy here on this earth, but we can go to them again. and we'll be together for eternity with God in heaven. And so there is a comfort, 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 13 through 18. Those words are meant as words of comfort. And so that's one thing that always highlights and comes to my mind is David has a totally different response to two different sons there. And we much have the same thing today. And so the warning there is, of course, die in that state of forgiveness, die in that state where we can look forward and say, I can't bring them again, but I can go to them. And so I'll close with those thoughts. And Chip, maybe I know I've run through some of that kind of fast, but anything that stood out at you?
Well, one of the greatest lamentations over sin that we know of is found in Matthew chapter 23 and verse 37, as Jesus says, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets and stonest them which are sent unto thee, how often would I have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings, and ye would not. Again, lamenting over sin. He had sent messengers. He had been as helpful as he could be. But they had turned away from him. So there is a natural reaction to, you know, this sinful rebellion and the situation that Jerusalem had placed themselves in, the same way that Absalom had made bad choices. So our choices are important.
Right, right. And, you know, we warn and warn again of the eternal consequences of those choices. But also I think we see in all of that, and especially as you consider Matthew 23 there, the love of God. His desire is for all to be saved, but it comes down to the choice of the individual. What will you do? And so some great chapters there, certainly some great lessons concerning sin, consequences, but also that we can have hope following the forgiveness of sin. And so thank you for joining us today. Hope that you will already be making plans. Join us once again tomorrow morning, 9 a.m. Central Standard Time. We'll continue our study right here in 2 Samuel, hosted by Chip, and he'll be in with us. And also then continue looking forward to our studies as we go along. Hope you'll join us through the remainder of the morning and the afternoon. We've got some great programs coming up. As always, we hope that you have a great day.
Listening to Mornings for the Master on the Gospel Radio Network. Remember to join us each weekday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. Central Standard Time or catch the replay at 9 p.m. Central Time. You can also contact us at mornings@tgrn.org if you have any questions we can help you with, or if you have events you would like to submit to our bulletin board, or just with general feedback about the program or network. We would love to hear from you. As we've had opportunity to spend time with the Master this morning in His Word, let's remember His words in Luke 6:46, when He said, "Why call ye me Lord, Lord, and do not the things which I say?" He goes on to say in verse 47 and 48, "Whosoever cometh to me and heareth my sayings and doeth them, I will show to you whom he is like. He is like a man which built an house and digged deep and laid the foundation on a rock. And when the flood arose, the stream beat vehemently upon that house and could not shake it, for it was founded upon a rock." Let's show the wisdom of that builder and go now to live for the Master.